This morning, we'll be taking a look at his more radical legacy with Dr. Claiborne Carson, Martin Luther King Jr., Centennial Professor of History, and Founding Director of the King Research Institute at Stanford University. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Good to talk to you, Janine.
How would you say that his memory seems to have been hijacked by people who would rail against him if he were alive today?
Well, I think that's one of the prices for having him as a national holiday, is that everyone can take their own piece of him and honor that part of him, and I'm okay with that. Mm. I wish that there was a broader conception of his more challenging ideas, because in some ways I think he's a reassuring legacy, and I think he would have wanted to be a more critical voice in terms of the dialogue about what kind of country the United States is and will become.
And his last sermon, entitled "Why America May Go to Hell," it's never cited. Can you talk about?
Well, he didn't actually deliver it. He was
okay.
He was thinking about delivering it at the time, and you know, it's not. That probably would have been a stronger sermon, but some of the ones he actually delivered were quite strong, too. And in fact, the speech he gave at Riverside Church condemning the war in Vietnam was kind of a sermon. You know, he delivered a version of it at Ebenezer Church. So he could be very strong in terms of his critique of American society. And of course, he was a minister. So that critique came out of his religious values.
And can you talk about that speech, "Why I'm Opposed to the War in Vietnam"? We've played it a number of times, actually, on the station.
Well, one of the things we're doing is playing a new recording of that speech. We're going to release it. It's a much clearer version than what all of us have heard before. And in fact, even on our website, we were using the version that most people use, which was released as a record back then, and it's been released in many cases since then. But there is a much clearer version that was in the Riverside Church archives and had never been publicly released. So if you closed your eyes, you would think that Martin Luther King is right there delivering the speech. It's that has that kind of fidelity. And it's a really strong statement. It still remains a strong critique of American society.
Do you think that speech is what led to him being murdered?
Not directly. I think that, you know, there's enough. I think his death was kind of overdetermined, in the sense that there were lots of people who disliked him because they saw him as a communist. There were people who disliked him because he was a black leader. And I think it's hard for me to imagine Martin Luther King surviving the 60s. There were attempts on his life. There were many threats. His house had been bombed. He had come close to dying back in the 1950s from a stabbing attack. He was assaulted on many occasions. So, you know, he was a person who generated strong emotions from people who disliked him. And it was quite clear that his ability to rely on police to protect him, when you look at the circumstances of the assassination, it didn't take a great deal of sophisticated planning. You know, he was quite exposed. He had no bodyguard right there who would have advised him not to go out on the balcony. So I think that he was a person who recognized that his life might be short, and he only lived to be 39 years old. But he had the courage to speak up, and he definitely did in that speech at Riverside Church.
Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee said that King would be appalled, quote unquote, by the Black Lives Matter movement decrying police brutality. That kind of goes in line with what I was saying earlier about how his legacy has been hijacked to some extent. What do you make of Huckabee's statement about King being appalled by Black Lives Matter?
You know, that's obviously absurd. You know, he was a person who spoke out for human rights in the broadest sense of the word. And if anything, I think he would be a strong voice in favor of that movement, because one of the things about him is that throughout his life, he was trying to achieve a goal that went far beyond simply civil rights reform. I think the best way of describing it is global social justice and human rights. So we're still a long way from that. I think that one of the aspects of that, I guess what you call the hijacking of him, is the way in which his speech at the March on Washington is emphasized. You know, that's a 16-minute speech, and it's kind of a call for America to live up to the values of the Declaration of Independence. But in so many other speeches, he went far beyond that, before and after the March on Washington speech. One of the things he says right at the beginning of his speech against the war in Vietnam is, "You haven't really been listening to me." And I think to some degree, that's the case today. His last book was Where Do We Go From Here? And it was written after the passage of civil rights reform. And I don't think we've answered his question. We still haven't decided where are we as a nation and the world going beyond civil rights. And because civil rights have always been this concept of rights that are given to us by governments. And I think that what we find is that governments are poor protectors of human rights. In King's speeches, he spoke out for the ideal of human rights. He's honored as a civil rights leader. But what he was suggesting is that we take the notion of human rights seriously. And one of the problems with civil rights is it applies to only citizens. But the human rights document that he referred to at the March on Washington, referred to the Declaration of Independence, and there's no mention of that only American citizens have unalienable rights that were given to them by God. And so we have all of these current issues, like what's happening at the border. Why is there such a gulf between how we treat an American citizen and how we treat people throughout the world? We talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but our government carries out murders in the world through drone strikes. And so our government reserves the right to sentence people to death. And so I think it's a clear indication that for King, the goal was to achieve human rights on a global scale. And he made that clear when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. He made it clear at Riverside Church. He made it clear in his last book where he talked about the World House and how we have inherited this house called the Earth, where we have to live in it with people of different perspectives, different races, different religions, but we have to live in the same house with them. And unless we learn how we're going to do that peacefully and with empathy, he warned us we will have Vietnam-like wars going into the future, and that is exactly what has happened. We've had more years of warfare than in peace, and there's no other country in the world that has that kind of a history. We definitely have not learned how to empathize and understand the perspectives of people other than ourselves.
Definitely very much in agreement with that. I was thinking earlier, the image that I get when I think of Dr. Martin Luther King, and even with everything that I know about why he opposed the war in Vietnam, Poor People's Campaign, sanitation worker strike, I mean, the list goes on. I still have to admit that in my mind, when his name comes up, and even in black households that I go in, it's the I Have a Dream speech, and it's the, well, this is not my idea, but I feel like the prevailing idea is that he reached his goals and that his goal was only integration, rather than his goals were cut short with his murder, but that his ultimate goal of us being integrated was fulfilled, and that was it.
Well, I think anyone who looks through his papers, which we are publishing, and looks back at, as a 20-year-old divinity student, he lays out his agenda as a minister. It's to deal with unemployment, slums, and economic insecurity. He doesn't even mention civil rights. And what is he doing? This is in 1948. And what is he doing 20 years later? He's leading a Poor People's Campaign. So from his perspective, I've heard this idea that he became radicalized. That was his perspective as a 20-year-old. What happened was that for 10 years, he became, I would consider, an accidental civil rights worker. Because he was concerned about civil rights, but his agenda was much broader than that. And the fact that he went to Montgomery rather than Mobile, Alabama, for his first pastorate meant that he was in the same city with Rosa Parks. That's what made him into a civil rights leader, is that not he, but women, basically, started a bus boycott movement and selected him to be the spokesperson for it. So that's what made him into a nationally prominent civil rights leader. So what he was doing at the end of his life is actually much closer to his initial vision than being a civil rights leader. But I think that in the end, what he's saying is that if you're surprised that I'm taking a stand on Vietnam, or if you're surprised that I'm leading a poor people's campaign, you just haven't really been listening carefully to me. You don't know the roots of my ministry. And I think that that's the best way of looking at him. If you look closely at what he was trying to do as a minister, is he was trying to deal with problems that are still very much with us. So rather than seeing him as being unconcerned about things like police brutality and Black Lives Matter and mass incarceration, that would be central to his concerns.
But what about the idea of him being compared to someone like a figure like Malcolm X? Because I think part of the reason why, and especially in his death, why he can be upheld by white society is that he was not, although he was a threat, he was not as threatening as someone like a Malcolm X. And the reason why his legacy might be so watered down is that compared to someone like Malcolm X, he seems to be more of a good, non-threatening Black leader.
Well, I think that betrays kind of a misunderstanding of both Malcolm and Martin. I've written about both. And one of the things about Malcolm X is that he was also trying to express his political voice, but he was constrained within the Nation of Islam. And rather than being militant, the Nation of Islam was at that time apolitical. You know, they were not out there demanding civil rights. They believed that salvation would come from divine intervention. And to me, that's as passive as you can get, you know, because my own feeling is God helps those who help themselves, and, you know, waiting for something miraculous to happen. And I think Malcolm was a critic of that. And especially after Birmingham, he was pressing for his own organization to become more active. I think that's one of the reasons why he eventually broke away and started his own movement. And also, in starting that movement, wanted to ally himself with what I guess we would call the civil rights forces, at least some parts of it. In his grassroots speech, he talks about joining forces with the grassroots elements in the movement. He was skeptical about people like King. He thought he was too cautious. But definitely he felt that Black Americans should demand the right to vote. And at that time, Elijah Muhammad was saying, don't even vote. And, you know, he understood that you're not expressing strength by not demanding the rights that you should have. The right to participate in decisions that affect your life is a human right. And there's nothing conservative about that. It should be a given that if you are living in a country where other people exercise power over your life, that's not a good situation. And if there's a peaceful way, or at least a nonviolent way of achieving that, you should be doing it. So I think that there's a misunderstanding. I strongly believe that if Malcolm and Martin had lived, they would have found a lot of common ground. And I've written articles about that. And it was unfortunate that Malcolm was killed before the people were arranging such a meeting between Malcolm and Martin. And I think that would have changed a lot of attitudes.
And can you talk about what happened after Martin was killed, the riots that ensued? Because on the timeline, Malcolm was killed a couple of years before Martin. Is that correct?
And about 3 years, yeah.
Can you talk about what happened to, and maybe I want to say the Black community in particular first, with Martin's murder, how that impacted the African-American community? and the riots that came after his death?
Well, I think there's two questions there. To me, there was a lot of an outburst of anger and throughout Black America after Martin's assassination. I think the more serious thing is we didn't answer the question that he asked. He's asking it for everybody, but Black Americans didn't answer the question of where do we go after civil rights reforms. I think it's still an unanswered question. I think there's still a lack of real clarity about where we should be going, and certainly a lot of lack of unity around that question. But I think it's mostly just a lack of clarity that's an important and vital question to answer. If we don't know not only where we are going, but who we are going with us, you have to clarify who is going to be your ally in terms of making a better world. And now that's a global question. We have to address it. Where do we go from here? And if he's asking that question in 1967, and here we are in 2020, and we still don't have a definitive answer to that question, we've been missing out on a dialogue that needs to happen. And I think that there is a real lack of clarity. When we go to the ballot box, what do we want the person we're voting for to do? To me, the guidance is not going to come from the top down. It has to come from the bottom up. It has to be, we demand this, and if you are willing to go and use the resources of the United States government to help achieve that, I will vote for you. But the guidance has to come from us. It rarely comes from above. I mean, no political leader, elected leader, started what we call the civil rights movement. That came from outside government, and it put pressure on government, including Black people who are in government. And I think to some degree, the success in getting Barack Obama elected president, it made us feel, again, like the direction was going to come from him. No, it's not. A politician is simply a tool in our hands.
What would you say, in your opinion, is the most misunderstood part of Dr. King's legacy?
That he was a product of a movement that he didn't start and he could never control. I think that there's this kind of charismatic view of him that, without King, there would not have been a movement. And maybe people would not put it that strongly, but that's just a total misunderstanding of history. And, the Montgomery bus boycott would have happened if King had never lived. He said that himself. The sit-ins would have happened if King had never lived. He was only coaxed into a sit-in once. The freedom rides, the voting rights campaign in the South, no one was waiting for King to give the signal, let's go and do it. They did it, and he responded to that. And he should be given credit, because a lot of people didn't respond to that. He should be given credit for stepping to the plate and saying, yes, if you want me to lead, be the spokesperson of the Montgomery bus boycott, yeah, I'm willing to do that, even though it might mean my home getting bombed. But we shouldn't pretend that he was the one. Rosa Parks was the one who started that boycott. And women were the people who brought it together. Black women, many of them maids who had to spend 381 days walking to work. That's the people we should be thinking about as when we think about the bus boycott. He gave great speeches, and that's very inspiring to people. But that wasn't his movement. That was the movement of thousands of people, and he was the product of it.
And when you think of Dr. King, what is the thing that stands out foremost in your mind?
That he was willing to take on a task that he could not have expected and that he knew would put him in great danger. And because of his religious faith and his conviction, he was willing to accept that. He was willing to accept the possible consequence of that he would die. That every single day he could look, when he got dressed, he could look at his chest and see a wound from a wound to his chest that could have killed him. So he knew that he was mortal. And I think that he had to, not many of us are willing to take that kind of a risk. And Coretta, I think it's important to give her a great deal of credit, that when Martin was assassinated, and in most cases, you would assume that a wife would say, I need to grieve. I need to take time to myself, take care of my kids. What did she do? She got her kids together, put them on a plane, and she and her kids went to Memphis and carried on the march that he would have led. I can't think of anything more courageous than that. Somehow we forget her in this. I knew her for 20 years as she was the one who selected me to edit her late husband's papers. And, I think that she deserves a great deal. She should have at least some monument someplace that honors her.
So we've been speaking with Dr. Claiborne Carson, Martin Luther King Jr. Centennial Professor of History, founding director of the King Research Institute at Stanford University. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's been great speaking to you.
Thank you.